Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Matt, WOSU reporter Matthew Rand in for Ann today. Christina Johnson, president of The Ohio State University, last week announced she had made the difficult decision to resign. The news surprised the community and has raised more questions than have been answered. Roderick McDavis is the managing principal for AGB Search, which offers executive search, interim search, and compensation evaluation services for higher education institutions. He also served as president of Ohio University for 13 years. Roderick McDavis, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you, Matt. Good to be with you.
Thank you so much. And we should make note as well, we did reach out to Ohio State President Christina Johnson for an interview. Our request was declined. Roderick McDavis, as we just said, you're the former president of Ohio University. Can you just reflect for us for a moment on that, what that post was like for you, what brought you to Ohio University, and what your tenure was like?
Well, Matt, it was the highest honor of my life. I'm an Ohio University alum, and so coming back to Ohio University for me was a great honor. It was 13 years. It was a point in my life where we wanted to focus the university on reaching a higher level of excellence, and so we worked very hard over those 13 years. But one of the things, Matt, that I observed about my own experience is that there was an evolution that occurred over those 13 years as the job became much more difficult in terms of the level of stress and strain. So at the end of my tenure, you know, I was spending a lot more time on the job than I did earlier in my tenure. And that was something that I think has continued with presidents that are serving in those positions today.
Yeah, that's interesting, this change that you witnessed over the course of your time there. What were your duties, responsibilities? How would you describe the job when you started versus by the time you left?
Well, I think, Matt, what happens when you're starting a presidency is that you're very much involved in the life of the campus. As that time goes forward, you also then become much more involved in the community, perhaps even depending on what your experience is, you may get involved in some regional and national events and activities. And fundraising takes a huge part of the job. So that I know at the outset of my tenure, I had some time on Saturdays and Sundays, but as that time moved forward, I found myself working 24/7. So the job actually moved from 5+ to 7 days where you had to be constantly involved in the life of the campus as well as the life of the community.
I'm going to ask you in a moment about kind of the behind the scenes things that people might not think about. But first and foremost, being the president of a university, you're the public face, right?
Yes.
You're the mascot almost, or just as much of a large profile as a school mascot. People see you and look to you in times of crisis. Certainly, talk to us about that and what it's like to be out in front, so to speak.
Yeah, Matt, that's really a great point. You are the face of the university. And so whether it's good times or bad times, people look to you to make statements. If there's something to celebrate, they want you to be kind of the primary cheerleader for the university. If there's something negative that occurs, they want you to be that voice that of condolence, that voice that soothes the pain that people are feeling. So you become kind of the chief advocate of the university and certainly the spokesperson for the university. And so you're always on call. It's a little bit like working in an emergency room where you never know what's going to happen, but you have to be prepared for whatever comes in on any particular day. And so that is a role that many people are unprepared for when they step into a presidency, because you anticipate that you have to have some public facing, but you may not anticipate that you have to do that all the time.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Matthew Rand, sitting in for Ann today. We're talking about the announcement that Christina Johnson, president of Ohio State University, will be stepping down, making that difficult decision, she said, to resign from her post. And we're talking about the pressures and the responsibilities of university presidents in general. Our guest this segment is Roderick McDavis. He is the managing principal for AGB Search, which offers executive executive search, interim search, and compensation evaluation services for higher education institutions. And as we were just talking about, he also served as president of Ohio University for 13 years. Mr. McDavis, as we were just talking about the sort of public out in front aspects of the job, what are some things behind the scenes, some parts of the job the public doesn't see, especially when it comes to, you know, the pressures the president is under, the responsibilities that you face?
Yeah, that's a great question, Matt. So what you have is you have a lot of meetings and appointments that take up a lot of time during your day. And then you're literally invited to every event that happens on the campus. And so you have to parcel your time wisely. And what happens over a period of weeks and months is that takes a toll on a president, because every day you're literally going from about 8 in the morning sometimes to about 10 at night. And so you kind of do that 3, 4, or 5 times a week. And then all of a sudden the weekend comes and you don't get any rest. And so you go into that next week feeling a little bit more tired than you did the week before. And unless you can kind of tune out a little bit, take some weeks off, which is very difficult for most presidents to do, you find that the grind just wears on you over time. And so we used to see that most presidents served anywhere from 6 to 8 or more years. Now we see most presidents serve about 4 to 5 years, because the job has become 24/7. Those meetings, those events, those activities that you have to get yourself involved with, the fundraising, it just takes so much of your time that there's literally no downtime. And so you find yourself reaching a point where you say, you know what? I think I've given it my all. I think I've given it my best. I think it's time for me to step aside and allow someone else to come in and do this work.
It's just, it gets to a point, I take it, where it's just not sustainable. As much of an honor as it is to be in that role, you can't do it forever.
And Matt, that's what we're seeing across the country today. So that again, I think I'm a bit of a dinosaur in that I served 13 years. I think now we're seeing that, again, that 4 to 5 years is about the length for a lot for the tenure of many presidents. And certainly you look around the Big Ten and you see that to be the case, that there are a lot of other presidents across the Big Ten that haven't served more than 4 or 5 years. And so, again, it's not just in the Big Ten, it's not just Ohio State, it's across the country. We're seeing this in our work, that many presidents are just serving a shorter amount of time. It's good for our business, but it's not good for higher education, because you'd like to see the tenure of a president who kind of initiates some strategic priorities or set some goals. You'd like to see them stay through to see how that, see the results of some of those initiatives that you started.
You mentioned fundraising. That's such a huge part of being a university president. How much of your time ended up being devoted just to fundraising?
So it was a steady progression, Matt. At the outset of my tenure, I spent a lot of time trying to do some internal things on the campus, and so didn't really spend a lot of time fundraising until about the middle of my tenure. And then from that point to the end of my tenure, I'd say from about years 5 or 6 through 13, it progressively built up to almost half of my time by the end of my tenure that I was spending on fundraising. Now, we had a major capital campaign that we were undertaking, and so that takes an enormous amount of time, but it progressively took up much more of my time than I thought it would. So I'd say by the end of my tenure, it was about half my time I was spending fundraising.
I do want to ask you about OSU President Christina Johnson. From a public relations standpoint, how does kind of the mystery surrounding her decision to resign affect the university?
Well, you know, the great thing about institutions like the Ohio State University is that they have a great infrastructure. And so more often than not, the university can manage itself through the other senior administrators that are in the university. While the president has some responsibilities with the everyday oversight of the institution, there are other senior officers and other mid-level administrators in place to make sure that, you know, the trains run on time, so to speak. So I don't think it affects that very much. I think that the impact is from the standpoint of a strategic vision for the institution, where it sees itself going. Most presidents like to set out a vision for where they want to take the university. And so I think more than anything, that begins to change because people now are unsure of what the future vision will be because, you know, the current president has announced that she's stepping down.
The president, of course, answers to the Board of Trustees. Do they have to approve the plans the president has for the university? Things like hiring faculty, plans to reduce student debt. How does that work?
So Matt, some decisions have to be approved by the board, certainly the budget, and I think the strategic vision for where the institution wants to go. But things like hiring administrators, hiring faculty, those are decisions that the board leaves to the president and to the other administrators within the institution. So more often than not, what a board is responsible for is kind of the general oversight of the institution. They stay at a 50,000 foot level. The reason they hire effective presidents is that they want the president to be that person who's responsible for the day-to-day management of the institution. And as I indicated, I think Ohio State has a great infrastructure. So there are other senior leaders in place that will make sure that the institution continues to move forward. The biggest change will be where the strategic vision for where Ohio State wants to go 5-10 years from now will change with the next president who comes in. So I don't think that there'll be a totally negative impact. Obviously, you know, there are many people on campus who will feel sad that President Johnson is leaving. And so as a result of that, there's kind of that emotional impact that the campus has when a president steps down. But in terms of the actual everyday functioning of the institution, I think Ohio State will be fine.
We're used to thinking about the president of the United States, right? And with when the president of the United States is in their final term, we call it a lame duck, sort of a, you know, tail end of the presidency. How effective are university presidents sort of after the announcement that they're stepping down? What's left on the table to do, and how much can President Johnson accomplish in the remaining time?
So the greatest impact, Matt, will be that you don't make major decisions. You don't make decisions that will impact the institution for the next 5 to 10 years, if you will. The everyday management of the institution, the day-to-day management, that will continue. So what most presidents do as they have announced that they're stepping down is they make sure they don't make major, major decisions that will impact the future of the institution so that they inhibit the ability of the new president to come in and make those major decisions. But I think that most presidents kind of follow the lead of the person who preceded them in understanding that now that I've made that decision, I want to make sure that I can complete some of the agenda that I put in place. But I also want to ensure that I don't set the next president up for failure by making some major, major decisions that will interfere with that president's vision. So again, I think Ohio State's in a great place. It's an AAU, highly regarded institution across the United States, great academic programs, great facilities, great students, great faculty. So I think that the infrastructure of the university is strong enough that it shouldn't have a negative impact on the institution for the next 5 to 6 months.
Well, with the search presumably getting underway here for a new president at The Ohio State University, what do you suppose happens now? Do you think, President Johnson's decision might make candidates out there for this position wary of applying, seeing that she only, we made about halfway through her 5-year contract?
I think what happens, Matt, in the searches that we've done where this has occurred is that candidates will typically ask the search consultants, so tell me a little bit about, why the president's leaving, and what will inspire them to go forward is if they don't hear that there's a major controversy, if there hasn't been a financial scandal, if there hasn't been something that will inhibit them from being successful. Most presidents that move to institutions like The Ohio State University want to come into a situation where they can be successful. So I think if there are personal reasons involved for why President Johnson is leaving, I don't think that will deter people from following her. So again, those are conversations that prospective candidates will have with the search firm. They may want to talk to people on campus to get a sense of why they think President Johnson left. But at the end of the day, Ohio State's a very strong institution, financially stable. The fundraising is effective. Obviously, athletics are in a great place. So you've got a lot there to work with. And that's what candidates want to see more than anything is, can I be successful if I come into this situation?
And one more question I want to ask you about. Later in the program, we're going to be talking about a study suggesting that the college president searches tend to favor white men. And I'm curious how that has played out in your career and impacted your trajectory as former president of Ohio University.
Matt, what I can tell you is that we do about 25 to 30 presidential searches a year. One of the searches that we just completed this past a year was the chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We've done the University of Iowa. We've done the University of Nebraska. So we've done some other Big Ten institutions. What we're finding in general is that the pool of candidates is becoming much more diverse over these last 3 to 5 years. That's a good sign. So what that means is that first and foremost, boards are looking for a diverse pool of candidates, and people that serve on the search committees from the campus are also asking the search firm to create a more diverse pool of candidates. So my hope is that going forward, not only for the Ohio State University, but for other universities across the country, that the pools of candidates include more women, they include more people of color. And I think that's a distinct change from when I applied to become president, because back in that time, there were fewer people of color who were applying for the presidency. There were fewer women, but now we're seeing a change in that. And I think that's a change for the better. So I'm cautiously optimistic that that will continue for the foreseeable future.
Terrific. Roderick McDavis is the managing principal for AGB Search, which offers executive search, interim search, and compensation evaluation services for higher education institutions. He also served as president of Ohio University for 13 years. Roderick McDavis, thank you so much for your time and being on All Sides.
Been a pleasure. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you. Much more to come. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Matthew Rand, filling in for Ann Fisher today. And with the announced resignation of Ohio State University President Christina Johnson, a new search for the 17th president of OSU will soon begin. We're looking at the role of a college president, what goes into the search for one, and a new president this hour. Judith Wilde is a research professor at Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University in Virginia, and she has studied university president searches, the contracts they sign, for over two decades. Judith Wilde, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you. Thank you, Matt.
So Ohio State University President Christina Johnson is resigning just over 2 years into her five-year contract. You refer to this as a failed presidency. What do we mean by that?
When we talk about a failed presidency, we are not talking about anything that she did during her presidency. She may have been very successful in doing her job. When we talk about failed, we're talking about someone who leaves before the end of their term. And typically, we more specifically talk about it if they've been there maybe 2 years, a little more than that, or less.
So it doesn't refer, as you said, to the accomplishments that a president may have made during their tenure, during their time at the university, but what's, I guess, a failed presidency certainly has a negative connotation. What consequences, what does it mean for the university when a presidency fails?
Well, there are several things that it means. In this particular case, since no one knows exactly why President Johnson is leaving, that leaves sort of a rumor mill. If it does come out later that there were what are often called just differences with the board, that may cause some problems in hiring another president, because they'll go in saying, what happens if I have those same problems? So that's one issue. The next issue is using a search firm, which right now over 92% of searches are done using an executive search firm.
And that's been an evolution, correct?
It has. We actually looked at this across 50 years. And if you go back to 1975, 76, about 2% of searches were done using a search firm, and that was only private institutions. It's now roughly equally both private and public. And our last time we looked at it, which was a couple years ago, it was 92%.
What are the pros and cons here? What are universities finding utility in going through a search firm to find their president?
We're seeing more and more that the people who are on the Board of Governors, I'll just use that generic term, Board of Governors, that they are more and more bigger business people. You know, it used to be the local bank president, that type of person. Now we're getting sometimes national figures at some universities on their board. They don't have the time to do a search. They don't necessarily know how to do a search, since the average board is like 5 to 6 years. They may never have done a search before. So the analogy I use is that the search firm comes in like a knight in shining armor on their white horse and says, we can take care of this for you. We can do all of these things and you don't have to worry about it. The issues, so that's the good side, is that a search firm can be of help. They may have more outreach. They may be willing and able to do more cold calls to people who might not consider it. On the negative side, they tend to be expensive. There tends to be little due diligence. In some of our research, we've found that if you look at the heads of search firms, there's only one who has been a tenured faculty member, a dean, and a president, and a provost. And you just spoke to him.
Yeah. I'm curious. It sounds great, right? It sounds like there's a really solid sales pitch involved, a lot of big promises, right? It's a high stakes hire that universities are trying to make. How well do these search firms live up to that promise?
Well, we actually believe that one of the reasons we're seeing more what we've defined as failed searches, and the reason that the average length of time in office for presidents is shortening, is in fact due in part to search firms. While they are fairly expensive, one of the things we've looked at multiple times in our studies has been due diligence. What kind of due diligence do they do? What are they looking at? And we look at the contracts. We don't ask what was promised to them orally. We look only at the written contract. That's the only thing you can hold their feet to the fire for. And the most frequent thing that search firms do, and it's only 51% of the contracts that in our study, is contact the references that the candidates suggest themselves. Anything else is less than that. So, and frequently they put into the contract that they'll do more, but they will hire a third party and they will not guarantee the work. Other things they put into the contract is that they will only do searches of publicly available material. That means saying, and sometimes they actually list things like LinkedIn, Facebook, and so on. Well, my LinkedIn, I could say I have a JD, a PhD, and an MD. Doesn't mean it's correct. Nobody checks what you put onto LinkedIn.
Yeah. You're listening to All Signs with Ann Fisher. I'm Matthew Rand, sitting in for Ann today. And we're talking about the role of university presidents, the search for a new president in light of the Ohio State University president, Christina Johnson, announcing her intention to resign. My guest is Judith Wilde. She is a research professor at Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University in Virginia, and she has studied university president searches and the contracts they sign for over two decades. And you were just talking to us a little bit about what's in those contracts, what's not. Is it standard practice for colleges and universities to sign presidents to 5-year contracts.
That's pretty much the standard, yes. Yes.
And I guess that's the measure then by what we're going off of, where this idea of a failed presidency. Just got to make it to that 5-year mark. But that's, you're saying, increasingly more difficult for university presidents to achieve.
It is, and it makes it the whole process even more expensive, because in nearly all contracts that presidents sign, they are guaranteed that when they step down from their full contract, when they step back, they have what are called retreat rights, which means they become a full professor with tenure within the university. And so if there's a president that is leaving, and there may have been some issue that's a real cause for their leaving, or even if they've just chosen to step aside, but the Board of Governors really doesn't want them to hang around, then they have to buy out that time. And we've seen some fairly high payouts, as high as over $4 million to get rid of a president that they no longer want. So that's another expensive thing. Purchasing agents tend to see the agreements with search firms as a relatively minimal cost. However, what they're not thinking of is that what they're really purchasing is a president. And as you know, we just saw recently in Florida with Ben Sasse becoming president of the university down there, across 5 years, that contract is worth $9.7 million.
With the high cost of these searches and the stakes when they don't work out as well as the university might have hoped, are universities rethinking how they go about searches for a president?
I hate to say this, but we haven't seen much. The local search committee, the faculty members, staff members that serve locally on the search committee, in many cases have to sign non-disclosure agreements that they will not talk about the search. We've seen a few that are quite egregious, saying that if they ever talk about the search, they could lose tenure, they could go to jail. Now, those are two extreme cases. But you know, one of the ways to find out about presidents is through faculty. Faculty have a great, great, great grapevine. If I don't know somebody, I know somebody who knows somebody, or they know somebody who knows somebody, and you can learn a lot about presidents that way. And there, or, you know, we see more deans even becoming presidents now. So somebody will know. And not being able to use that network really adds to the issues of being able to know enough about your president before they're hired. Along with the idea that even in states with sunshine laws that technically require multiple candidates at the end, multiple finalists, we're finding that there are ways that searches are getting around that, and there'll be one candidate listed at the end. It's sort of a drum roll, and you know, the Wizard of Oz, we're going to pull back the curtain and there's your new president.
A lot of pomp and circumstance here. This is there's a lot of motions that need to be gone through, I guess, is the effect there.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When we're talking about these search firms, are larger colleges and universities more likely to use them than smaller institutions? Does that play out?
Not really. That doesn't seem to play out all that much. The larger ones may be willing to pay more money to get, you know, for a large contract, because many of these search firms are paid based on how much the president's going to get. Some search firms have a fixed price that they will charge. Others, it's more of a contingency, and it's typically 30% of any monies that the new president is given during that the first year in the job. So, of course, it behooves the search firms to find the most expensive president they can.
Yeah, certainly. A lot of money on the line here. Now, this search for a new college university president, as we said, is expensive. Is the cost, and you may have said this already, but the cost of paying the research firm part of the president's salary?
No, it does not. In the, if I'm understanding you, it does not come out of the president's salary. No, it is a separate university expense.
So it's not thought of as a section of that. So this, and when we talk about failed presidencies, especially, the high cost, much hay has been made about the high cost, right, of higher education in general. How much of that is a contributor when it comes to these high profile, high dollar amount university president searches?
Well, we recently looked at one. If you look at the average cost of tuition at a flagship public university, it's, I don't remember, around $12,000 or so. If you divide that into what is being paid to the search firms, you could certainly have a lot of scholarships given to students. And these monies come some from the state. Where does the state get it? From the public. You're paying your taxes, students are paying tuition, you have your donors to the university giving money. That's where this money is coming from. So, is the best use of that money hiring somebody to do a job that used to be done totally internally? At very little financial cost. A time cost, yes, but little financial cost.
Sure. And your research, as we've said, kind of suggests this rise in research firm use has led to this increase in the number of failed presidencies at institutions across the country. So, again, kind of just what do you think is the reason for this?
When you don't have enough due diligence about the president, and the president comes in without really having been on campus, not really giving faculty or staff or students a chance to get to know that person, and then you're suddenly finding out something, I don't want to say is wrong with the president, but you find out things of their history that you may not like, that may be counter to what the general tenets of the university are. That's going to cause an issue immediately within the university. I'll give you one quick example. University of Oklahoma hired a former congressman several years ago, and businessman. His first day on the job, it was a secret search. His first day on the job, he started firing people and getting rid of some of the educational programs. Didn't go over well.
Yeah.
He stepped down after 11 months.
Wow. Now, based on your research, then, what recommendations do you have for colleges, universities, when they go about searching for a new president?
I think that search firms, as I said, can be helpful, but I think you need to limit some of what you ask them to do. I think that the local search committee needs to take on more of the due diligence and do some of the reference checks and background checks on the potential candidates themselves. I think they need to bring the candidates to campus so that everybody gets to know one another. Generally, just be more open and transparent. These secret searches also tend to go against a basic tenet of higher education, which is shared governance. We
Sure.
need to get that back. And with that, we also need to look at who goes on to the local search committee. Search committees tend to replicate themselves. If it's an all-white search committee, you're more likely to end up with a white president.
Judith Wilde, a research professor at the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University in Virginia. She has studied university president searches and the contracts they signed for over two decades. Judith Wilde, thank you so much.
Thank you, Matt.
More All Sides on the way. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Matthew Rand, filling in for Ann today. A search will soon begin for the 17th president of The Ohio State University now that President Christina Johnson has announced her resignation. Meanwhile, a new study finds that when it comes to searches for college presidents, white men are favored. The study was led by Estella Mara Ben-Simon, founder of the Center for Urban Education at the University of Southern California. Estella Mara Ben-Simon, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, so thank you. For our listeners, just how are the searches for college and university presidents favoring white males? How did you come to this realization?
Well, our study was in California, the three public systems of higher education. We interviewed 54 presidents from the three systems, the University of California, California State University, and the community colleges. And through those interviews, we found that the norms that govern searches tend to favor whiteness, not only in terms of individuals who are white, but also in the presentation of candidates. So for instance, what we found in our interviews, both with white men as well as with presidents of color, that in order to be able to make yourself appealing to a search committee or a board, you have to present in ways that are white, meaning mannerisms, language, how you look, how you're dressed, the fact that, for instance, women of color having to be careful about their hair. Now, we had one woman saying, "I could not go with my braids to an interview." So the point of all of this is that most search committees are predominantly white. I heard your previous guest. And so there is a white schema in terms of how you see people, and there is a preference, therefore, for those who present themselves in ways that that make search committees comfortable. So this is all to say that for candidates of color, there is a burden of having to not only show that they are qualified for the position, but they have to do that in a way that does not appear that their selection would be a risk. And often that's why candidates of color may not be selected, because they're seen as a risk.
Yeah, this idea that a candidate has to perform in a certain way just to get that meeting, that interview, just to be considered, right?
Yes, exactly. And also, there are other kinds of built-in biases that advantage white candidates. So, for instance, the preference for candidates that have come through academic affairs, who have been a faculty member, who have been a department chair, who have then been a dean, who have then been a provost. You know, there's a trajectory. And often what we overlook is that academics of color have not always had the opportunity to follow that trajectory. And in fact, often candidates of color, individuals of color, come through student affairs because that's been the door that was opened to them. And then so they're excluded from searches, particularly, you know, research university searches, because they don't have necessarily those that, you know, the academic credentials that go through, in, you know, being a faculty member. But the other aspect of it is that there is a bias towards where did you get your degree from, right? And if you got your degree from, say, a historically Black university or from a Hispanic serving institution, there, that is also a, you know, that just kind of puts you out of the running for the presidency.
Well, colleges.
So there's this sector bias. Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
Sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off, but with college campuses, as diverse as they are and growing ever more so, student body wise, and certainly the faculty and staff as well, why aren't we seeing more diversity at the top spots?
Well, for a variety of reasons. First of all, boards of trustees are predominantly white themselves. And so they may not necessarily be thinking about how to diversify the pool or the fact, for instance, looking at themselves. I'll give you an example. In California, the university, UCLA, since its founding, has only had white male presidents. They have never had a woman. They have never had a person of color. Now, UCLA is not a predominantly white institution in terms of its student body. So one of the things is the boards. Boards are the ones that make decisions about the hiring of a search firm, which was your previous discussion. They make decisions about how search committees are formed. And often they're not aware, they're not thinking, oh, we did not ask this search firm what their experience was in identifying candidates of color. So one of the things that needs to be done is to ask the search firms different questions that are being asked in order to understand, in order to see if they have the experience to be able to identify candidates of color. You know, search firms are also predominantly white. So we have search firms that are predominantly white. We have boards that are predominantly white. And then often they end up creating search committees that are predominantly white because it's not in their mindset to be thinking about why is it that we're so white?
What are... Obviously, it's a noble goal that universities should be striving for, to have their leadership reflect the diversity they see in their student bodies. What are the benefits of diverse leadership at the collegiate level?
Oh, there are many. One of them is that, first of all, let me just, I don't know the context so much of Ohio State University, but I know the context in California. 70% of the students in the public system are from racial, ethnic backgrounds. You know, they're not white. Only 27% of the student body is white. So students need to see themselves in leadership roles. And white students also need to see in leadership roles people of color. But the other thing is that that presidents of color are more aware of changes that need to be made to create campuses that are responsive to the needs of Black, Latinx, Indigenous students. They're much more aware, for instance, about the need to diversify the faculty. So presidents of color come with a set of experiences, both lived experiences as educational experiences that make them much more aware of what needs to be done to be more successful in creating racial equity in educational outcomes. And white presidents may not be thinking about that because we tend to think of ourselves as good people and we're doing the right things and don't realize that those right things are often racialized. So, you know, and there are studies. There was just recently a report published by Education Trust that actually delineates the research that has been done on the consequences of having diversity in the faculty and how that impacts educational outcomes. We need to have precedent, at least in my state, we need to have precedents who reflect the population. You know, we're 40%, California is 40% Latino.
And how should, we've just got a few minutes left, but how should colleges and universities go about redesigning, right, their searches for presidents with all of this in mind?
Well, in our report, we not only described the problem, but we also provided a toolkit. It has five different tools, and that covers how to select a search firm, how to create a search committees that are racially diverse, what kinds of interview questions to ask presidents. So I would say that if a university decided, we're going to do this differently, we're not going to follow the script that we have followed for the last 50 years, because, you know, the script hasn't changed in terms of the way, except for the advent now of using search firms. But it follows the same steps that have been done over and over and over again. And so I would say that our toolkit provides a way for totally redesigning search firms, and it's available. I think we provided you with the links. So that is one of the things that I would say, starting with how you even describe the position announcement. You know, most universities do not talk in their position announcement of racial literacy or racial equity competency as one of the requirements. It's never mentioned. And so that's what I would advise, to take a look at our toolkit. Finally, what I would say is, you know, boards are like, as somebody we interviewed said, they're like electric sockets, and they can either give energy to racial diversity in the selection of the presidency or shut it out.
We have just about a minute left, but we're living in this time where the role of race in higher education is being called into question all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, right? Do you suppose this will be a factor in how searches for college and university presidents are selected going forward?
Yes, I think that there we are in a period now in our country where, particularly now with the affirmative action case at the Supreme Court, that makes it even more difficult. It will make it more difficult to talk about race or to use race as a priority. Nevertheless, I think that there, regardless of the Supreme Court decision, I think that the imperative for racial equity in this country looms very large. We cannot go on in the way that we have gone. We cannot say we will admit students, but we will not consider their diversity. And in some states, institutions cannot survive without that.
Estella Mara Ben-Simon is the founder of the Center for Urban Education at the University of Southern California. She led a recent study on the predominance of white men as college presidents. That's all the time we have. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.